There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend. There's a new world coming. This one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you can hear it if you try. And it's growing stronger with every day that passes by. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. You know the one I'm talking about, the one we've had visions of, and it's coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy. Come in peace, come in joy, come in love.
And I saw another sign in heaven. That's singer, songwriter, pianist, arranger, actress, and human rights activist Nina Simone, born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in Tryon, North Carolina, with New World Coming. That's from her 1971 album, Here Comes the Sun. A very hopeful, hopeful expression in song, in direct contrast to where we are today. Nina's range spanned the gamut: classical, jazz, folk, blues, gospel, R&B, pop. She was at the height of her career in the 1950s and 60s. A battle with breast cancer claimed her life in France on April the 21st, 2003. She was 70 years old. She was inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame in 2009. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is, my goodness, where does the time go? It is Tuesday, September the 23rd, and your president is doing, as he called it, stupid stuff. He's doing stupid stuff, except now he's joined by five supposed allies in Iraq and Syria, where the battle supposedly against the Islamic State has been intensified with airstrikes against Islamic State strongholds in northern and eastern Syria. You may recall that the foreign policy philosophy that Obama articulated earlier this year that drew a great deal of reaction, more alarm than reaction, of the super simplistic analysis that he brought to this matter of foreign policy. He said, don't do stupid stuff. Well, that appears to be off the table because the war has now officially become a major three-pronged effort with Iraq and Syria and the Islamic State all in the crosshairs. In ordering the airstrikes in Syria and threatening retaliation even against any of Bashar al-Assad's forces if they should take any action in defense of Syria's sovereignty, the president has taken his stupid stuff doctrine to an exponential level of recklessness and lawlessness. Like his predecessor, George Bush, Obama is shamelessly lying about the reasons for his military action in Syria and in Iraq, ostensibly in pursuit of the Islamic State terrorists. We'll talk about this today, but I want first to give you some background. Here is President Obama basically outlining his philosophy, his deep philosophy. This was in a series of comments that he made after the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia, just last year. And he's here discussing that he had no plan at the time. Sounds familiar? He had no plan at the time with respect to Syria, which by then had been accused of conducting chemical warfare campaigns against its own people. And we will talk about how that was debunked later on by a group of international inspectors. But he says that he had no idea yet how to deal with Syria. But of course, we know that's not true. All along, there's been a plan for Syria. And that he was not considering any military action then that would require long-term commitment to war in Syria. So here's President Obama laying out his very profound thoughts after the G20 summit in St. Petersburg.
I was elected to end wars, not start them. I've spent the last 4.5 years doing everything I can to reduce our reliance on military power. But what I also know is that there are times where we have to make hard choices if we're going to stand up for the things that we care about. And I believe that this is one of those times. I knew this was going to be a heavy lift. I understand skepticism. I think it is very important, therefore, for us to work through systematically making the case to every senator and every member of Congress. And that's what we're doing. So in the coming days, I'll continue to consult with my fellow leaders around the world, and I will continue to consult with Congress. And I will make the best case that I can to the American people, as well as to the international community, for taking necessary and appropriate action. And I intend to address the American people from the White House on Tuesday. For the American people, at least, the concern really has to do with understanding that what we're describing here would be limited and proportionate and designed to address this problem of chemical weapons use and upholding a norm that helps keep all of us safe. Failing to respond to this breach of this international norm would send a signal to rogue nations, authoritarian regimes, and terrorist organizations that they can develop and use weapons of mass destruction and not pay a consequence. And that's not the world that we want to live in. We may not solve the whole problem, but this particular problem of using chemical weapons on children, this one we might have an impact on, and that's worth acting on. Is it possible that Assad doubles down in the face of our action and uses chemical weapons more widely? I suppose anything's possible, but it wouldn't be wise. I think at that point, mobilizing the international community would be easier, not harder. On Syria, I said, listen, I don't expect us to agree on this issue of chemical weapons use, although it is possible that after the UN inspector's report, it may be more difficult for Mr. Putin to maintain his current position about the evidence. I would greatly prefer working through multilateral channels and through the United Nations to get this done. When there's a breach this brazen of a norm this important, and the international community is paralyzed and frozen and doesn't act, then that norm begins to unravel. And if that norm unravels, then other norms and prohibitions start unraveling. And that makes for a more dangerous world.
Well, a couple of notes here. The president is, of course, referring to the contention that the United States officially had maintained that the Assad government had been engaging in chemical attacks against its citizens and, of course, used this as a pretext to justify the eventual attack on Syria. Except that a UN report by inspectors who had been dispatched to investigate these attacks and the alleged use of sarin gas came back with a report, 82 pages, that said they did see evidence of the use of sarin gas. They did not assign blame at all to the Assad regime. In fact, in 3 of 4 instances where the gas was used in attacks, the victims of the attacks were the Syrian army. And in one instance, we had there were attacks against civilians. But it was unlikely that the Syrian army would be using the gas against itself. However, other sources, most notably Seymour Hersh, the investigative reporter, talked about the fact that the Obama administration actually lied. They knew that the gas was not used by the Assad regime, but they lied about it in order to justify the eventual invasion and attack against Syria. That's how long this had been going on. The will of the United States was to invade Syria and to get rid of, and we even heard words like neutralize Bashar al-Assad. And we know what that means. It means to assassinate him. He has been in the crosshairs of the United States for a long time. So when this United Nations report came back, they were not dispatched to find out who is to blame. They verified only that the gas was used. In 4 instances, 3 of them, the victims were the Syrian army. And in 1, civilians were targeted. And so the question arises whether the credibility of the United States actually should be accepted without question. Seymour Hersh's articles, in fact, were buried by the U.S. media, the media that is so compliant and is part, they're part of the whole propaganda scheme. But here's a president saying, you know, I'm here to end wars. I'm not here to start them and all of this. And today we are learning that 5 Arab allies have partnered with the United States in bombing positions within Syria. Bahrain, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And the United States is now promoting that this is, in effect, a kind of coalition of sorts. You notice they're all Arab states, and they're not well thought of, should I say, very politely. In fact, pardon me if my memory seems to be fading, but wasn't it Qatar and Saudi Arabia? Weren't those 2 countries in particular singled out as the funders of the terrorist campaigns? Weren't these countries tied to terrorism, furnishing weapons, furnishing money, giving their support? And now they are the U.S. allies, and the news reports are all over the place about the United States and its allies. The U.S. didn't attack Syria by itself. It had a coalition of stalwart countries. So you have to ask yourself, what is going on here? And all of this blatant lying presented as if it were just, I mean, the, things are going by the book. We have the same invocation by Obama that George Bush used, weapons of mass destruction. We knew about the credibility of that allegation to justify the invasion of Iraq. And now we're hearing that from the president in this clip, we hear that the justification for the eventual invasion of Syria was that it has weapons of mass destruction. Completely untrue. In fact, he referred to Russia. Russia brokered an arrangement where any weapons that it had that would be considered weapons of mass destruction, and it wasn't to that grade, but still Syria was quite cooperative in opening up and getting an international review of its weapon systems, including weapons classified as weapons of mass destruction, by the way, which the United States did use in the attack on Iraq. It used depleted uranium as part of the bombs. The 32,000 bombs had dropped within a 48-hour period when it invaded Iraq in 2003. Depleted uranium, a weapon of mass destruction, was among the weapons used. So when the president today and the United States and the generals and the Congress and all these official bodies present to the world that the United States is acting not alone, but it's got the support of Arabs. And look who they are, reviled in the Arab world. They're reviled in the Arab world. And you have to think, doesn't anybody kind of put one and one together and come up with the notion that these kinds of actions would tend to create massive negative reaction in the very world that you're looking for support from? You're going to present and give authenticity to Qatar that has been funding terrorism, and Saudi Arabia funding terrorism, and this has been established? And now you are comfortable with the idea that these folks are part of your coalition. These are your buddies in war. And it kind of is appropriate when you think about it, because the United States itself, I mean, it has taken lying to a whole different level. Nobody trusts it, because it is the height of hypocrisy and just plain lies, lie after lie after lie. But here's the problem. This action now increases the exposure of the United States. This is the odd thing. It increases the exposure of the United States to terrorist attack. What they did yesterday by invading the sovereignty, and we talked about this, the sovereignty of Syria, they already did it with Iraq. There's no international consensus. Sure, the president will say, well, I have the permission of Congress to go to war. Well, yeah, you can get the permission of Congress if you wish, and we know about them. And it wasn't unanimous, far from it. You had stiff opposition in the House and the Senate, more so in the House, which actually authorizes war. There isn't unanimity of agreement that the president is doing the right thing. In fact, there's great criticism that he is breaking the law, including the law of the United States. And the country is very calm about this. This is, and people said, well, you're being a little bit, you know, being a bit alarmist when you start talking about World War III. This is how these things start. You have a renegade government, a renegade president, who believes that he's smart. He's a smart guy, and all the people around him are so smart. And they know how to manipulate things. They know how to manipulate the law. They know how to lie. They know how to utilize the media to propagate all these lies. They know how to do all of that and still look like, that Mr. Clean. But it is, in fact, a continuation of a sordid way that the United States operates, both with its own citizens and in the international community, in the world community of nations. This is why it is so reviled, and this is why we have such a dedication by many people in far-flung corners of the world who say that we cannot abide this presence on the planet. We are going to attack it. And people don't understand. Why is the United States so hated? This is why. So now you are not only invading the sovereignty of two nations because you decided and you say, well, Congress gave me permission. Well, that's not the only permission that you need. And everybody knows that. The United States could not prove that it was under imminent attack by ISIS or the Islamic State or whatever it is that you choose to call them. I call them what they say they want to be called. They say they are the Islamic State, then fine. But when the United States acts like this, and it consistently acts like this, not a single report today reporting on this allied effort in the attack against Syria, not one report bothered to raise the clear alarm and the stunning fact that among the allies are states that have been associated with supporting the very terrorism that the United States supposedly is fighting. That they were part and parcel of the terrorism that the United States is fighting, supposedly. Not one. They're all into this jingoistic mode. Yes, America's going after those nasty bastards and they're going to kill them in good. This is a great time to... We had McCain saying in public, look, in as much as we're going to be there, why don't we do a threefer? You know, we could take out al-Maliki of Iraq, take him out, and you know what that means. We'll take Assad out and we'll take the Islamic State on. Now, why are you telling us we can't do all three? Since we're in this thing, let's go for it. Let's go for broke. That's the mentality that we saw in the Senate with John McCain and others of that ilk saying, let's have ourselves a great, nice war. And all this posturing about the high and mighty ideals and democracy and all that stuff that they will start waving the flag in your face to tell you this is about the safety of America. And look what the truth actually is. The United States is officially part of a conspiracy of terror. It officially is. It is involved. It has taken on terror partners and selling it to the people as if, well, we have a broad coalition. We're all against terrorism here. No, we're not all against terrorism here. Just about everybody in this coalition is engaging in terrorism. And without the permission and, I should say, the strong consent, never mind the vote in Congress, and that already indicates that it is not an overwhelming good sell to the representatives, and we know we attack them all the time, but at least there was evidence of resistance to this madness that this president is putting this country in. Not only the country, but the world, because now it's going to mushroom exponentially. It's going to force a reaction within the Muslim world. And it is going to force a reaction among nations that are coming to the realization, hey, wait a minute, this thing, you know, there are too many troubling things here. You will notice the European nations are backing away in a way. They're giving voice to the need to confront the Islamic State and all of that stuff, and they're talking all that talk. But they're not down with the fighting. They're not into it as deep as the United States wants them to be. Join us in this killing spree, and we'll divvy up the spoils later. The intent is so clear. The intent is so clear to reorganize the so-called Middle East, whatever it is they say it is, middle of what and east of where, nobody quite knows, but they've been calling this region the Middle East. But to reorganize the region to suit specifically the interests of the United States and with compatible co-conspirators, to suit their needs, to lay claim military dominance of the region, and through military dominance to lay claim to the resources and to the all of the things that you could get from the land and the people of the region, but to revitalize this notion of empire. That's really what this is all about. So it is really disturbing that today you're looking for reports that say, well, you know, the president or there's greater resistance in Congress, and people are asking these questions on an international level. No, the media reporting, hey, great, we had great airstrikes last night. Fantastic, they did a great job. And guess what? We have Arabs now with us. And that's the way they're reporting this. It's outrageous. This president has taken a craziness to a whole different level. And the United States will pay for it. I guarantee you. It will pay for it, because this kind of recklessness speaks to the notion of serious supremacy, notions of world domination, that you could do anything. You're a law unto yourself. You don't have to obey anything. You don't have to give deference to what other nations are thinking. You don't have to abide by the rules. You are the rules. You are the law. You can do whatever you wish to do, and nobody dare oppose you. We'll continue this discussion throughout the week, but I just wanted to bring this to your attention, that the President Obama's official foreign policy philosophy, don't do stupid stuff, is officially off the table. This is really stupid stuff. We'll take a break and come back and talk about big money in the green movement.
And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw it as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that have gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN FM, your favorite station, and I hope that you stick with me. We all saw that great historic march it was referred to, a historic march. And it was indeed, because you had reported 400,000 people showing up to express their concern about global warming and the need for the international community to step up to the plate in a concerted and purposeful way to harness the emissions of poisonous gases into the air that are choking us to death little by little and bringing an end to the planet, if not at all arrested. So that was a historic movement. But I read a wonderful piece by Arun Gupta, who is an investigative journalist and who contributes to many publications and journals. He is a former international editor for The Guardian, to which he still contributes, and the former editor-in-chief of, I should say, co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And it's a delight to have you, Arun, with us today.
Hi, how are you doing, Yatrice? It's Arun.
Well, I loved the quote that you said in your piece when you were talking just prior to this march, that you felt that there was a bad feeling, you said, you had about the People's Climate March. Were your feelings vindicated by what you saw?
Well, I should make, an important distinction. I don't want to leave a misimpression. When I say that I have a bad feeling about this, line from Star Wars, I was referring more to the organizing leadership than the march itself, and especially
sure.
The march participants. I think, you know, the people who turned out, they were enthusiastic, they were energetic. For many people, it was a way to feel a connection to a broader movement, that they're not in their little town fighting against fracking or mountaintop removal or other issues directly related to climate change. And, you know, they feel isolated in that. It's a way for all of them to come together. So that serves a really important function. Now, at another level, it's where's this all headed, though? That is the huge question. That is maybe the defining question of the next 50 years. Because if we don't do something about this climate crisis, and the time has passed for serious action, the effects are only going to get worse and worse and worse. You know, the amount of warming, the amount of habitat destruction, species extinction is going to accelerate rapidly. You know, we basically have a system, a capitalist system, that treats the planet Earth like a rent-a-car. But to be able to do something about this, we need really powerful social movements. And that's where my criticism is that from talking to many different organizers to doing investigations of what is exactly going on behind the scenes, what is the strategy of the organizing leaders, I have serious reservations, as do many other people. And the feeling is that they are pushing this into a centrist and mainstream, and they'll even kind of admit it themselves, that we need to build a broad tent movement, but they're pushing it into the Democratic Party and the electoral system. This is the same failed process that is giving us this crisis. Barack Obama went to Copenhagen and in 2009, I believe, at the end of 2009, and he basically helped sink any action on climate change, along with China, Saudi Arabia, Canada, the really big polluting countries. And his role has not been to advance action on climate change. It has been to actually make the crisis worse. And so supporting a process that looks to try and support the Democratic Party is, you're just undermining the very movement you're trying to build.
Well, you talked about the troubling influence and the troubling evidence of big money in the movement. Could you address that?
Well, what I was looking at specifically was one group called Avaaz. As near as I can tell, there were there were a number of groups early on. It's a very complicated story because climate justice activism has been going on for decades. A lot of it is really in grassroots, indigenous communities, people of color communities, the people who are bearing the worst effects of the climate crisis and have the least to do with it because they're not profiting off of it. They're not even getting the jobs. They're just getting all the pollution and poison. So there has been a lot of talk among grassroots people of color community about doing something. But then Avaaz, it's a global online activist organization, and 350.org, which is this environmental activist organization led by Bill McKibben, the scientist and reporter, and Naomi Klein is on the board, who just came out with a book about climate change, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. They were the ones, as near as I can tell, that were really central to initiating this march. Now, the issue with Avaaz is, what I was told, is that they have found that climate change fundraising, which are these emails that they sent out, is consistently one of their best performers. And by performers, it gets the most response, it gets the most money. They sent out an email in December of 2013 that was just, total hyperbole. You know, it starts out saying we have 24 months to save the planet and everything is off the charts and worse than we expected, but we could stop this if we, get together and work to pressure world leaders who will be coming to Paris in 2015 for a climate summit. So it's a very effective form of fundraising. First you scare the living bejesus out of people, and then you offer them hope, and it's an easy hope. You know, it's basically you just click on this button, sign this petition, you give them some money, and everything's solved. We're going to do the work for you. And according to inside sources, it appears that this email campaign raised millions of dollars. And it was about this time that Avaaz was having conversations with 350 about doing some big action at the climate summit that is actually going on today in New York City. And so from the beginning, this has been driven by money. Now, 350 is more complicated. Avaaz gets its money from its base, from its members, quote-unquote. It has 38 million emails. Therefore, it says it has 38 million members. So, you know, who knows how many of those emails are, you know, bots or dead accounts anymore. But in any case, 350.org also gets a lot of donations, but it also gets foundation funding. And I didn't really go into it that much because it's a much more complicated story to tease out. And they're also not as dependent upon this form of fundraising. And people I talk, you know, of basically trying to constantly generate revenue from the base. And people I talked to also indicated that it was Avaaz who was really footing much of the bill. Now, the problem that comes in is Avaaz is footing the bill. They are saying we're going to do something about climate change. One of the things they say is we need Occupy-style protests. Now, there were people who got involved in the organizing very early on, veteran activists in the New York City region, who were pushing for, like, hey, let's make this like Seattle in 1999, where tens of thousands of people peacefully shut down the World Trade Organization ministerial, and that gave birth to the global justice movement and derailed any sort of global trade treaty. So that was an incredibly powerful moment. Now, it would be extremely hard to replicate that. The cops are much more savvy about this. But nonetheless, people did want to have a more militant action. They also wanted to name the system, which is capitalism. This is at the root of the crisis. Instead, what these activists and organizers told me is that they were stymied at every turn, and it all became about the march, and the march was completely watered down. There were no demands in the original call to action. There was no mention of global warming, no mention of climate change even. It didn't even mention the UN climate summit, according to people who are involved in the process. It was just, the call to action was something big is going to happen, historic is going to happen at the United Nations, and you should be there. And it was absurd. You know, it's like, if you can't even name what the problem is, how can you advocate for any sort of solution? And so basically there was a big behind-the-scenes struggle to have some clearer wording, and eventually they did mention the issue of climate change at the UN Climate Summit. But a number of people told me, and it's easy to find the statement on the People's Climate March website, you can see it doesn't mention greenhouse gases, it doesn't mention coal mining, it doesn't mention fracking. So if you cannot mention what is really causing this devastating climate change, especially in the United States, that is a real problem, you know, because if you can't even get to that step, how are you going to advocate for the type of radical solutions we need? Scientists are saying we basically need to go carbon free by mid-century. You know, maybe we can go carbon free by the end of the century, but, you know, we've locked in so much warming already, it's going to get worse and worse, even if we go carbon-free tomorrow. So if you can't even say what some of the things that are causing it in your propaganda and your literature, then you have a movement that stands for nothing and that will be completely hijacked by the powers that be. And I think that's part of the problem. So even though there was all this great enthusiasm, you know, there was a huge participation by youth. This was a march where we saw many more people of color and somewhat more organized labor activity. It was essentially being taken over by the vested interests. Ban Ki-moon was the head of the march. He's today pushing this corporate design carbon pricing initiative. Barack Obama endorsed the march. He tweeted an endorsement of it. And like I mentioned, he's been one of the leading climate criminals in the world. So they are essentially allowing the movement to be co-opted, and none of this is in the open. You know, it's one thing to say, like, hey, here's our strategy, come join it if you want, but they're not being honest about their strategy because I think they realize that so many people would oppose it.
You mentioned specifically the role of the Democratic Party. How does the Democratic Party figure into this? I mean, of course, we saw Al Gore heading the march along with Ban Ki-moon. What's the connection between this organizing effort and the Democratic Party?
Well, I think, you know, it's not a direct effort. It's not like there's pulling the strings. You know, I tend to look at things more in systems analysis. The individuals are not particularly relevant, so you don't have these people behind the scenes. What it is one person explained to me, you know, they said, this was a senior staffer at one of the organizations. They're like, look, you know, we don't expect much from the UN Climate Summit. You know, the goal of this march is to essentially create more space for politicians to take a clear stand on climate change, saying something needs to be done about it. You know, so what this is it's about funneling everything into electoral politics. And part of the reason that I was very suspicious of it is, in many ways, in form and content, this is very similar to the Iraq anti-war movement. In 2004, 2006, and 2008, there was a conscious decision by the main anti-war group, United for Peace of Justice, to basically ramp down protests against the U.S. war in Iraq and to make it more about supporting the Democrats. Now, as we know, the Democrats are every bit as complicit, if not even more complicit, than the Republicans. The Democrats are total warmongers. You know, we see Barack Obama has basically launched more wars than Bush. You know, he's much more aggressive. He's asserted the right to the extrajudicial assassination of U.S. citizens. You know, we just launched a new war in Syria and Iraq on top of Afghanistan and Pakistan and Libya and Yemen and Somalia. I mean, it's absurd. So this was a strategy of the anti-war movement. Now we have no anti-war movement, and we have eight different wars that are going on in the world. The war on terror has become normalized, and I'm really afraid that the climate crisis will also become normalized. It'll be it. The new normal will be terrible, but humans are remarkably adaptable. That is both our strength and our weakness. We can adapt to really horrendous conditions, you know. So So just to get back to your question, I don't think there's like an absolute direct link, or there's not one that I can see. I think the way to put it is overlapping interests. But I will point out there is this billionaire. I think his name is Tom Steuer. He's announced that he's going to be spending, you know, huge amounts of money, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars, trying to get candidates elected who support action on climate change. And again, it's about working within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is really just one wing of Wall Street. And so he sent out an email saying, like, just today or yesterday, right after the big climate march, that, you know, we need to take, you know, all this energy and put it into the November election. And my response is no. You know, that's absurd. Depending upon this same failed political system to create the solution is ridiculous. It's just like these carbon pricing schemes. What they do is they reward the polluters. They give these pollution credits to the electricity companies and the coal companies. And the idea is like, oh, this is going to help them cut their emissions. And all you're doing is you're giving them free money because they can sell those credits, right? So you just end up reinforcing the very same system. And that is really what a lot of people, I think, and, you know, I want to emphasize this isn't just me. I've talked to dozens and dozens of people, in fact, probably over 100 in the last couple of days, people who came up to me and were like, that was a great article, that was right on, it needs to be said. There are some people who are also critical, that's fine. We need to have this debate in the open. That is one of my main points. This debate is not happening in the open. They want to suppress any sort of debate of what their strategy is, the leaders of the movement, or rather, I should say, the people who are funding the movement.
Well, I had myself remarked, how do you get 400,000 people in one place and there are no demands? I mean, usually, people gather because they have a shared interest in pushing forward with an agenda, but that was a question I myself had raised. I want to talk about how do I describe it? It is a cultural hegemony, if you will, within the movement itself, and it is typical of the progressive world too, straight across the board, where the idea is whites would dominate as the control systems, and people of color will do the heavy lifting. Noting, as you did, that much, if not the brunt of the fallout from climate change has been borne mostly by people and communities and nations of color, why is it that it is coming across, unless I'm reading it wrong, it's coming across as if they really are on the periphery here in terms of making policy and directing the course of the struggle?
Oh, it's simple. It's about power. You know, I think that's the thing we need to understand about money and class in our society, right? At a base level, you want to be able to have the necessities in life, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, you know, those things. But if you start to accumulate a lot of money, millions of dollars, it becomes a way to accumulate social power. And that's what we have, is we have a class-based system of social power. And people of color don't have the money. You know, they just, we're still in the throes of this devastating economic crisis. We've seen enormous destruction of African-American wealth, Latino wealth, to the point that it's been virtually wiped out, especially within the African-American community. And so you don't have communities that have the means to be able to organize. They are just struggling with all the particulars of daily life. You know, can I get the bus to the job on time? You know, can I find someone to care for my kids? You know, can I make it to class? Am I going to pay these medical bills? They don't have the means to organize. Now, some people I talked to regarding the march said they felt there were positive things in terms of putting communities of colors first. And I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm not entirely sure what's going on. But at the same time, I've talked to people who are like, well, you know, it's more complicated because for some of these groups, at least, they're putting communities of colors first because they're trying to diversify for their funders. In other words, it may be tokenism appears to be an issue. I don't want to reduce it to that. It's never reducible to that. But that may be influencing some of the decision about which groups do, people of color groups do get put at the forefront. You know, again, it goes back to the point we're not having an open debate about any of this. There's not open strategizing. And I'm not at all suggesting that we somehow have, like, general assemblies of 400,000 people. You know, I'm not opposed to hierarchy. I just think it needs to be transparent and accountable. And what we have now is a non-transparent and an unaccountable hierarchy.
Well, you anticipated my follow-up questions, and you answered them before I could ask them. And that is about, you know, what do you see as being immediately needed to put things on course? But as we wrap up, Aaron, for yourself, what do you envision as the you've been involved in the struggle for a long, long time. What do you envision as the way that regular people should be understanding or interpreting this particular fight?
Well, I think, first of all, it's incredibly important that everyone do whatever they can to get involved in your local groups, in regional, in national organizations. You know, I don't think a lot of people are like, oh, get involved locally. This is not a local crisis. The crisis will be felt unevenly. It'll be felt very differently, depending on where you live and what resources you have. But the atmosphere, there's only one atmosphere. There's only one oceanic system. There's only one terrestrial system. And it's going to affect the entire planet Earth. Everyone will be affected. But what we need to be doing, I feel, is to be building the democratic accountable organizations. And I don't think we should fetishize the local, nor should we fetishize horizontalism, because this is one of the critiques I made in that article as well on Counterpunch, is that, look, you know, for the second time in 15 years, the liberals have come in and co-opted a militant uprising, first in Seattle with the Global Justice Movement, now post-Occupy Wall Street. You know, a lot of this movement is trying to trade on the energy of Occupy Wall Street. And so the people in the radical movements need to ask themselves, why is that? What is the deep flaws within our political analysis, within our structure, that allows the liberals to come in? Why can't we build national organizations that can contend for a position that really helps shape and guide the movement and to give it that type of militant, systematic analysis? And base of power it needs to take on the capitalists. You know, capitalism wasn't built in a day. This is the industrial system goes back 250 years. The financial system goes back 500, 700, 800 years. There are different ways to date it. So it's not going to be dismantled overnight. As bad as the climate crisis is going to be, we have to view this as a multi-generational struggle. So that means building bases of power. It doesn't mean dropping out of society. It doesn't mean, you know, you just have your little farm and live your low-carbon lifestyle. That's going to do nothing to stop the ecological crisis. It may make yourself feel better. But we need to vie for the central system of power, and we do need solutions on the level of the state. I'm not saying it has to be state-led solutions, but this crisis is so enormous, it requires that state-like coordination and response to move to a zero-carbon economy.
Thanks so much, Aaron Gupta, for being with us today. The article is in the current edition of Counterpunch. Thanks so much with us today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And you can write me and let me know what you're thinking about these programs at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Pass the word, tell a friend about this program and about PRN.FM. We'll see each other tomorrow. A great program. You don't want to miss it. And a pleasure and a privilege, a great privilege, to be in your company.
Around the bend, there's a new world coming. This one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling. it's growing strong with every day that passes by. There's a grand morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawn that belongs to you and